Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show on which we explore the mystery of the human personality and the mystery of the human adventure, all through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, your producer and co-host. I'm so happy you're here. We've got another great guest for you today. He's a returning guest, an old friend. We love him. Christopher Cook, Enneagram 1, Wing 2. He's got a brand new book he's authored, Healing What You Can't Erase. What a great title. What a great concept. Transform your mental, emotional, and spiritual health from the inside out. We're talking all things transformational today, folks. Transformation through the tool of the Enneagram. Such a good conversation. You will love Christopher if you don't already know who he is. Can't wait for you to hear this conversation. And now, without any further ado, here is the host of our show, Ian Cron.
Hey, Typology Tribe, Ian Cron here, back again with another episode of the podcast. You know what I'm going to say. The podcast on which we explore the mystery of the human personality, and more importantly, the mystery of the human adventure through the lens of the Enneagram. I'm joined by my good friend, Anthony Skinner, based in Franklin, Tennessee. Anthony, how do I find you today?
I'm doing good. Enjoying the weather here in Nashville. We finally, spring has sprung. So, doing good here in Nashville. Waiting for you to get yourself back here. And really excited because we have a returning guest today. And he's someone we know, someone we love. Make that introduction, Ian.
Man, everybody, if you did not hear the first podcast that I did with our friend Chris Cook, author of the new book now, Healing What You Can't Erase, Transform Your Mental, Emotional, and Spiritual Health from the Inside Out. If you did not hear that podcast, go back into our archives and listen to it because a lot's happened in our friend's life since then. Chris, Enneagram 1 that you are, welcome back to the show.
I'm so glad to see you both.
Yeah, great to see you.
It is great to see you, man. So tell us, as an Enneagram 1,
yeah.
Last time we spoke was in 2020.
Yep.
This book is about transformation. Mm-hmm. How have you, in keeping in mind the Enneagram, how have you changed since that time?
Wow. In many ways, and this is the work of my new book, transformation is such a slow grind.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And what I'm so thankful for in the awareness of even my Enneagram 1 temperament is that as an improver, I'm always like, hit the pedal to the metal, let's go, let's improve, let's fix. But the strength of that has allowed me to do some deep work on woundedness, on dysfunction, on blind spots in my own life, fear motivations, you guys. Like even the last time we talked, oh my goodness. I look back now, let's say 3 years from the last time we spoke here on the pod. You guys, I was still living under the motivation of some core fears of insecurity, inherent worth, that somehow my performance was tied to my value. And so I'd like to say in context of being dominant as a self-pres Enneagram 1, that improver overextended became perfectionism, striving, and you guys, it was exhausting. And mm-hmm. So the last 3 years since I've been on the pod has been even unraveling a lot of that even more. And so it's not been rainbows and sprinkles the whole time. There's been a lot of confrontation that has led to transformation. And maybe that's the beauty of the Enneagram. It is not a, hey, I've checked this box, I'm good, now I do other things. It's like, it is this reference point that I go, hey, okay, if one of the great gifts I bring to the world is wholeness, how is that somehow being distorted through a lens of anger, fear, my ability to love detail and precision overextended becomes criticism, self-hatred. So you guys, it's like, I'll even say this confidently and candidly 3 years later, it's not that our last conversation was inauthentic in the slightest way. But there was, if I'm not trying to kid myself, I'm like, okay, I've got to perform well so Ian and Anthony like me, so that the folks trust me, so that I'm in a good light. And you guys, like, that's insecurity. And I'm okay saying that publicly. I'm to the place now and still growing, like, you know what? At the end of the day, I'm learning to like myself. I'm learning to grow even deeper. I'm learning to love the simple things of life. If I'm quirky in one way and quirky in another, it is who I am. And it's not to say that I'm living this life of, I don't want to change or improve, but it is to say that you guys, I don't know, a lot of that drive to self-protect because of fear of rejection is gone. So, you know, a lot has happened since we last talked. Obviously, I've got a book out now, but suffice it to say, where we started our conversation last time was even like how I landed on Enneagram 1, how I mistyped. But you guys, like, this is the meta narrative of the strength of fear and shame and guilt and the insidious nature of those things to affect all of us in different ways. And the Enneagram, specifically your book, Ian, and the IEQ 9 have been like laser-like in my ability in community, like our mutual friend Kurt Thompson would say, like our confessional community, that has been a lifeline for me. So a lot's changed, you guys.
There's so much in this new book that I really love and that, resonates with my own thinking in the in the current moment. I think one of the mantras that I have in my coaching work, I have a couple of guys in their mid-30s, very successful, and working on transformation, the journey of spiritual and emotional transformation. And I remind them, I have my mantra is, one is this, is it's going to take a minute. Meaning, and this harkens back to a quote by a guy from Regent College, whose name I can't remember, but I remember the quote. He said that spiritual transformation is the slowest of all human movements.
Yes, I agree.
And that is true, isn't it? Like we, and unfortunately, we live in an ecosystem in which everyone's trying to hack the spiritual life.
You got it.
Or the emotional life. And you can't. There's no way to hack it.
No, sir.
And in part because, and this is something that you talk about in the new book, Healing What You Can't Erase, is because we overestimate the power of willpower.
Yes.
Talk to me about that, because you actually talk about that in your own, in the book, right? Like, here's a quote from it. If we're depending on willpower to change not only our situations, but also us from the inside out, particularly when we've lived in an elevated state of stress and survival for any length of time, we're building a house of cards. It's designed to fail from the get-go. So if willpower is not the key to human transformation, what is?
Yeah, so I'll give us the key, and then let me just kind of cycle back and unpack it. The key is the transformation of our hearts. And I'll get to that in a minute. Let's just put a pin in that for a second. So let me go back to the willpower capacity, and then we'll kind of work our way out of this. So here's the example. Imagine, I don't know, Anthony or Ian, you've got a 16-ounce bottle of water in your hand, and I've got a 5-gallon bucket. Those capacities are different. And like willpower, like agency, like gifts and talents, we all have different capacities, but none of us have unlimited capacities. And so as helpful as self-help devices are to getting us on the road, they cannot get us to our desired destinations, especially when we're living in a chronic state of stress. And so I'll just continue to unpack this. In a chronic state of stress, even stress caused by this maniacal fervor to effect meaningful change in life. So why do we exert willpower? Why do we go to self-help? Because we're stuck, or we're frustrated, or we're just not headed down the road that we want to head down. That fervor actually puts our bodies, our nervous systems, in a state of stress. And so when that happens, our nervous systems remain in overdrive, fight or flight, not rest and repair. And so no matter how much we desire change, will it, intend for it, we're going to hit a wall of limited capacity to create sustainable transformation in our spirits, souls, and bodies eventually, which is what we need. Okay. The stress and fear responses to life, you guys, because they live in the subconscious, not where the will is, they're a million times more powerful than the executive function of the mind. They're a million times more powerful than any assertion of desire, intention, or drive. And Ian, I'd love to even know, like in your coaching and your experience as a spiritual director, I've learned this, that like 95% of our interaction with everyday life is an outflow of the subconscious narrative. So what that means is it's not willpower. I mean, again, it'll get us on the road, fine. But we need to get to the root and heal the root to change the programming. Willpower says change circumstance, change stimuli. And that's fine. But when we change the heart, we can flourish and be in health even in the middle of adversity. Another way of saying the same thing is this. Maybe it's not our circumstances that need to change, but our lens by which we see the circumstances we're in. And that means healing the heart. Now, here's hitting the bullseye. I can't change my heart. I might be able to change my behavior for a minute, but I can't change my heart condition by myself. And so as a person of faith, I believe that the Holy Spirit can. So let me dive into that. Am I talking too much? Do you want me to keep going?
Keep going. Yeah. We're all okay. Right.
All right. I just want to make sure the friends joined with us today are getting this step by step here. Here's what I'll say. Heart transformation, as I speak about in the book, is systemic. The wisdom writer Solomon wrote that we need to guard our hearts. What does that mean? What does that even mean? Well, our hearts are our thoughts, our seat of emotions, the desires, our mindsets, our attitudes. And here's why. Here's what Solomon said. The heart affects all we do and all we are. It affects our paradigms, our motivations. Hello, Enneagram. Like, this is it, guys. Lock in. This is the Enneagram. The Enneagram isn't about behaviors. It's about underlying motivations, why we do what we do. So guarding the heart affects the motivations, perspectives, our emotional health, our biochemistry. And so even going back to where we started our conversation, my motivation under the influence of unhealed trauma was fear and self-protection, right? And so this is why heart transformation is the better option when it comes to making meaningful, sustainable change in life. And back to what you said, Ian, about spiritual direction and spiritual growth, it's slow, it's hard, it's not linear, it's messy.
It is all of that. For sure. I think the world of, I'm feeling rather rangy today. So I'm going to say some things that are, provocative. I think most of Christianity in the faith-based world, in faith-based publishing, is based on the myth of reformation, that you can actually actually reform yourself. And reformation is not transformation.
Come on, Ian.
Like reformation, as a therapist, I've tried to help reform people. And people think, I'm a good Christian. I'm trying to, and they confuse reformation, which is like trying, maybe I read it in your book. I can't remember whose book I just read this morning, but it's like we have addictions, proclivities, reflexive ways of acting, thinking, and feeling that we have absolutely no power over. Like, I'm just saying, like, forget it. Like, it's like trying to stop an avalanche with a traffic cone. It's just not going to happen. Right. Like there are parts of us that will eat our willpower for lunch. Forget it. I was talking to someone today laughing, you know, how many times have we said, well, today's the day I'm not going to have an inner critic. Good luck, right? Because you're an Enneagram one. Today, I am not going to have an inner critic. And by golly, and you try as hard as you can to stop the inner. You try as hard as you can to stop the inner critic. And then what do? Your inner critic beats you up for not being good at stopping your inner critic. Like, it's like, it is, you.
You're nailing it.
Reformation does not work. And this is something, and again, this is part of a new book project I'm working on. Like this idea that when we do that, all we're doing is taping fruit to trees. That's all we're doing. We're just taping our fruit to the tree. I'm gonna try and be this or be that and change this about myself and try this. And then it'll look good for a minute. But, you know, it doesn't, it cannot stand against what's going on inside the human heart. Am I resonating with what you're talking about?
In so many ways. Here's why. And let's just connect our two thoughts. You're talking about reformation and how it is not equivalent to transformation. Well, this is exactly the notion of neurobiology and neuroscience to say that in the limbic system, the survival brain, that's where the seat of emotions and traumatic memories and unhealed wounds, all that is there. And if 95% of our daily lives is run out of that subconscious tape that was recorded from ages 0 to 7, and now 35, 40, 50, 60, 70. I coached a 72-year-old man 6 months ago, and we found a core wound from his childhood when he was a little boy. He's 72 years old, guys, and he's trying to affect change in his life. And until we brought healing to that cellular memory, he was hitting a wall. Ian, I think you are exactly right. And what happens is, in Christianese, it's just self-help with a Christian veneer, and it's not transformative. I think you're exactly right, Ian. We've got to get to the issues of the heart on the path of discipleship and formation that really gives access to our hearts and is in the process of true transformation. And that's hard, and it takes time.
Yeah. Well, it's called rewriting a new story.
That's exactly
right, and which you've alluded to that when you talk about changing the lens through which we see. And usually that lens is narrative in shape.
Yes, sir.
Right? It tends to be, can be, well, explained, or part of it is illuminating what's the story we're telling ourselves and others about who we are and how the world works. And then interrogating that story. And then through a process of giving God consent to do in us what we cannot do for ourselves. See, that to me is, this is the, you know, people come to me and say, oh, how do I forgive my mother? And I'm like, okay, well, guess what? You can't. You just can't. I just don't think you can. Now, you can make progress on the journey. You can do a lot of things. But what you can do is give God consent to do in you what you cannot do for yourself. Namely, to forgive your mother. Now, I can give you practices that will help open you up to the transformative power of God, to allow God to do that for you. But you actually have to begin by telling yourself, I am powerless actually over this. You're jumping up and down.
It's confession, right? This is, so my good friend Jamie Winship teaches this. Oftentimes in the lens from which we operate, we think confession is saying, I'm sorry. But when Jamie was a police officer in DC, he tells this story. When he would bring someone in for a confession, he wasn't asking for an apology. He was asking for truth. We have to come to the Lord in truth. He won't deal with us in the false. Here's my mess. Here's what I believe about you. Here's what I believe about myself. Here's what I believe about others. And he's like, I can deal with that. I can work with that. As messy as it might be, it's true. Freedom starts with truth.
Yes. So now I'm going to go off in a weird lane. Here we go, Anthony, weird lane time. So one of the reasons I became a priest, an Episcopal priest, was because I had a very high view of Eucharist, or what some people call the Lord's Supper. Some people call the, you know, there's a bunch of whatever your tradition chooses to call it, right? When you see on the road to Emmaus, there's this which is maybe my favorite text in the New Testament. You have this moment where they don't recognize Jesus, right? Wow. And so Jesus begins to quote scripture, right? Looks at scripture. And they still don't get him. This is where Protestants get it wrong. They're always like, well, let's just go to the Bible. It's like, the two guys on the road still didn't get it after the Bible was quoted verse, and, you know, like by the master himself. They still didn't see who he was. It wasn't until it was twinned with an experience. And that experience was a meal. And the reason I'm saying this is because we tend to overprivilege the mind's ability to apprehend a text or an idea in the Bible and think, oh, that's going to change me. You need more than that, right? So what happens in the Eucharist is we break this meal. Something strange happens. But one of the things that happens is we have to put our hands out in this posture of openness and receptivity. And we open these hands, And into those hands is placed this bread. Now, I'm always telling people, this is why I do that every single week, because there's something that happens when we open our hearts, our hands, our lives, the interior posture to God and say, look, I can quote the Bible. I can read a million books. I can go on retreats. I can do whatever. And all those things may be helpful and supportive on the journey of transformation, but they themselves alone will not bring about transformation. Something, dare I say, supernatural has to happen, which is that one has to open oneself up to the pervasive, invading power of God. And to actually quiet the ego, which will say, we can do it, we can do it, we can do it, we can do it. If you just give me the power, I'll do it. You know, it's like, no, actually, you can't. You've fooled me too many times. I need to open myself up to an experience of God so that the fruit on the trees will come out of the branches on their own. And you will say to yourself, how did I change? Like, I cannot begin to tell you how many times this happens to me every single day. I will encounter a situation that used to bring up fear or anger or envy, as on Enneagram 4, or something else. And I will say, why am I no longer activated by that? That doesn't activate me anymore. Right. How did that happen?
Right.
It's not because I read the Bible a lot. It's because over a long period of time, as Eugene Peterson, borrowing from Nietzsche, once said, it's from a long obedience in the same direction. What I did is I just kept showing up and opening my heart to the most often imperceptible power of God to change me from the inside out, so that even I'm surprised at how different I am. That to me is a sign that the Spirit is at work. Like you're starting to do and think and feel things that you never thought, felt, or did before. And you're like, how did that happen? And you're like, oh, must have been God, because my willpower up until this date never was able to get me there.
Ian, I think that is so brilliant. Would it be okay for me to comment on that?
Oh, come on.
I'm so thankful for what you shared, because I see the thread running through this conversation being, again, the heart. I'll just repeat what I said earlier in the conversation for emphasis, and perhaps even to just come around what you just shared, which was so just brilliant. Heart transformation is systemic. Solomon says, guard the heart, guard the thoughts, guard the seat of emotions, desires, mindsets, attitudes. It affects everything we are, everything we do, and we offer the heart. What is the Lord looking for? The heart. I think the key to transformation in all of our lives is the condition of our heart. Very, very thankful for what you just shared.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Hey, Ian, the other day we were talking about times we lean on others and times we might pull back or withdraw. How do you find the right balance?
Well, you know, each of us have different needs, right, when it comes to our social battery. Like for me, I can be bursting with energy in the morning and then drained by the end of the day after meetings or speaking and just need some time alone.
So what advice would you give those who are struggling to find that balance?
Well, first, I recommend learning what you need to recharge, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is it more time with other people? Is it building space in your day to take time to read alone? If you're not sure, talking to a good therapist can help you figure that out so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp's online therapy, my friend, is a great place to start. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Their therapists can help you develop self-awareness and identify what fuels you and what drains you. Find your social sweet spot, friends, with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/typologypodcast today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/typologypodcast. There's by the way, if you ever have a chance, let me see if I can find it. But there's a great article in The New Yorker, and it was Patti Smith, the godmother of punk, God bless her, a brilliant writer, a brilliant National Book Award winner, just a genius writer. Patti Smith wrote a short story, and it's maybe it is maybe the most beautiful in compression presentation of the gospel in three pages I've ever read. And it's, I think it's called Sticky Fingers. And if you looked it up, it would be in the New York or Patti Smith, Sticky Fingers. But it's all about the heart and about desire and how we go off the rails when we try to make things happen on our own, apart from grace, which is actually, and I have to say it, I just think so many of us spend our lives trapped inside of an ego disguised as God that's trying to perform an act of self-salvation, and it can't be done. And it is frustrating, and it disillusions people because they just haven't been taught that the key is to get over yourself, to get over yourself, capital S.
100%.
Right? To transcend the self.
That's it, Ian.
And to allow God to do for you, again, this is the mantra, to do for you what you can't do for yourself. And I think that's what you're trying to get at here. In this, you know, wonderful new book of yours. And again, I'm going to remind people the title, Healing What You Can't Erase, Transform Your Mental, Emotional, and Spiritual Health from the Inside Out. Now, you as an Enneagram One, we oftentimes say every type has a core fear. The fear of the one typically has been the fear of being morally corrupt, of being fundamentally bad at some level, you know, but disordered isn't the right word. That'd be more four-ish. It's more like just morally corrupt. Is that your experience?
I think, just to nuance it a little bit, it's less about moral corruption and for me being defective at my core.
Okay.
Defective at my core, hence the inner critic, which is why, you know, we talked about this when I was on the pod last time. I mistyped initially as a six because of the unhealed wounds that were lighting up aspects of that, the test I took. I was like, oh, okay, six. But then as I experienced healing and went on this journey of transformation, it cleared the clutter, so to speak. And I more properly typed as a one, which resonates so deeply. And yet, as a one, that inner critic speaks not to my performance, but goes right to, you are useless and stupid. You are defective. You are at your core, just not good enough. That there is something in the language of the IEQ-9 assessment, that there is something, quote, intrinsically wrong with me. So it wasn't an issue of morality. It was like inherent identity aside from good performance. So if I, as an improver, one, bring wholeness as my gift to the world, overextended, in dysfunction, under stress, I then improperly translate the gift I bring to, if I don't bring it, I become perfectionistic. And I am defective at my core because apparently I didn't bring wholeness well enough or enough in and of itself.
So let me just say again what I said earlier, because I think this is a message of hope.
Yeah,
I hope this is a message of hope for people. It's gonna take a minute, and I just say this as a 63-year-old guy who only recently I had an experience with my friend Michael Cusick, this great therapist, and we were leading a retreat together in Mexico, and he had shared a story with me that led me to this moment where I'm in the shower. And I've got this beautiful window overlooking the ocean, the Pacific, and whales are jumping everywhere. It was just a beautiful moment. I'm sort of staring out the window, and I had this moment of realization that I felt whole. And I realized it had taken me 63 years to have that moment, a moment where I finally stood back and said, you know what? You're okay. I think I'm okay.
Can I ask you a question about that, Ian?
Yeah, please.
When you had that moment, what did it do to your body?
Oh, well, I mean, obviously.
Like, what did you feel in your body? Did you notice anything unclenched? Did you notice anything? Because I'm so fascinated by the integration of spirit, soul, body, and I'm curious about that.
Yeah. Well, the best way I can explain it, and by the way, this is a feeling that I think is not limited to that experience, but I can name other times in my life when I've had it.
Yeah.
It is the experience of dilation, where the chest opens. Uh-huh. And there is this kind of inner, and one would really appreciate this experience, where the clenching goes away. Where that inner clench, the pinch, that pinch at the core, that pinched feeling just kind of softens. And there's this dilation in the chest where you almost feel like everything's opening up and you feel this great sense of release and relief.
Wow.
Anthony, you're smiling. Why are you?
No, I just identify. I mean.
Yeah, right?
Oh, me too.
100%.
Yeah. So that's what happened for me in that moment.
Yeah, that's the reason I asked, because from that somatic perspective, as I got healthier and as I continue to get healthier, I can feel my one unclench, so to speak.
Yes.
And I can give and contribute and bring solutions without the gnawing fear of, if I don't, I am not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Powerful. Yeah.
Yes, but it is a gift.
Yeah.
And all you can do, this is my own, I'm sorry if I sound like I'm preaching today, Anthony, but here's the deal.
It.
All you can do is set the table for that experience. You cannot manufacture it.
What does that look like practically? I'm not trying to flip the mic.
Oh, no, I'm glad you did.
I'm so curious. Yeah.
Well, I mean, look, I think the first step is in the journey is the complete and utter admission of defeat and powerlessness. Mm. It really is. It's like, you just got to give up, man. Like, you have got to give it up. And everything you have tried to date has not worked. And so you literally have to hit. This is why when people show up in your office, or, you know, we deal with coaching clients or with patients or with readers and stuff, like, they think this is the worst moment. I'm falling apart. This is the worst moment of my life. It's like, yes, and simultaneously the best moment of your life.
Yeah.
Because all the old strategies and all of the old machinations of the ego have failed you, and you are finally ready for transformation, because you can now get you out of the way. Like, you have to fall apart before you can be put back together. And if you only partially fall apart, then a self-help book might do for now, just to kind of put a bomb on it. But it's not really going to change you. It's in the absolute moment of defeat. I cannot overcome this addiction to drinking or porn or to this. I can't give up having an inner critic. I can't give up this. I've tried everything I know how. And when you finally throw down and utterly surrender to God, higher power, depending on whatever your religious orientation is, then something, that's when the ice breaks up and the ship can move. That's my experience, right? So it begins, ironically, and this shouldn't surprise us as people of the cross. In defeat, there is a eucatastrophe, as Eugene Peterson once called it, right? A good catastrophe. And the good catastrophe is, in seeming defeat, is actually the beginning of your victory. But the victory itself will not be authored by you. It won't. All that will happen is that you will break up, your heart will break, and through the cracks then, forgiveness, mercy, and power can leak in. But it's, until that happens, all we're doing is moving deck furniture around on a sinking ship. That's what self-help books, and by the way, my books all appear in self-help sections.
Mine too.
You know, whatever, it always makes me roll my eyes, but that's just how the industry sort of, you know, decides to use displays. But if yourself could have helped you, wouldn't it have done so by now?
Thank you, Ian. That's exactly right. And why do books continue to be written, and why do we keep buying the books if they're not working in the first place?
Yeah, well, your ego loves a good self-help book.
That's it.
The ego, which is not a bad thing. Like, I don't want people to go, I hate my ego.
No.
It's
right.
Like, no, it's just your seed of self, and it thinks it still can be God. And it wants to save itself, right? And the key is, put your hands down, stop fighting, surrender. You know, do you remember, you're unfortunately younger than me, but there's this, but it's such an iconic film that maybe, you know, it was the Monty Python film about King Arthur. What was it again? Anthony, do you remember where he gets his limbs cut off? All of his arms and his legs keep getting cut off, you know, in a duel with King Arthur, and he won't give up. He's just like spurting blood everywhere, and he's like, "It's 'tis but a scratch. Come back here." And
Arthur's looking at him,
he's like, Yeah, it's a Monty Python.
The line was, it's just a flesh wound, I think.
Just but a flesh wound, right?
I don't know the movie, though, but I know the line.
Yeah, well, the idea is that the guy just won't give up. But it's in the giving up that comes the victory.
Ian, that was the first step to my journey of transformation. It was surrender. It was surrender. It's chapter 4 in my book, actually. Chapter 6, actually, is the art of surrender.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's embodied in everything you just said. So just for sake of time and not being repetitive, for me, Ian, I'll sum what you said brilliantly by saying this. Surrender, for me, wasn't just giving up. It was giving in to a process of laying down self, to a process of embracing the confrontation of dysfunction and woundedness that would lead to transformation. And so the fact that you just took us to surrender, I'm like, yep, that's exactly it. Because self-help says, dig heels, try harder, get in flow, whatever. That's fine. But my experience in transformation was, I've got to let go.
Mm.
Yes.
I got to let go. In the language of Hagberg and Gulick in their book, The Critical Journey, this is like hitting the wall, or St. John of the Cross, Dark Night of the Soul. These are these critical inflection moments, I think, for all of us, where we go, all right, what am I going to do? Am I going to dig my heels deeper and try to willpower my way out of this, or change my behavior, or change the circumstance itself? Or am I going to move through, like the law of non-resistance almost? I'm going to move through.
Yeah. I'd also, just playing with language a little bit, and mindful of the fact that precision with language is important.
Sure.
So I like let it go. And I come from a community of people where let it go is something people talk about all the time.
Cool.
Let go, let God, let it go. I actually think let it be is better.
I want to hear more.
Because letting it go, it too is an act of the will. Right, I got to try to let it go. Well, I don't know. I've known people who've tried letting it go forever, but I understand the sentiment of what you're saying. But I think letting it be, like, there's a moment you were asking me, how did you get to that moment? Do you think at 63, where you can finally look at yourself and say, I think I'm whole, or I'm as whole as I'm going to get. I mean, you know, Karl Rahner, the great Catholic theologian, used to say, we in the insufficiency of all things, I'm going to butcher this, but in the insufficiency of all things, we find that we die unfinished symphonies.
Wow. That's powerful.
I will die an unfinished symphony. There's no question about that. Right. So when I say I'm whole, what I mean is I have reached a stage, I think, in my life of acceptance, of peace, of being able to just be okay with what's not okay. And knowing that it's going to take a lot more time than I have here to finish this, for this finish to be finished in me, I should say. So that has been the journey. And it took a long minute. So the word of hope to the listener is, you know, whatever stage of life that you find yourself in, because in your 30s and 40s and early 50s, I'm just telling you, it's pretty hard. You just think you've lived long enough that you're like, this should have been done by now. But you haven't lived long enough for it to be done by now. Like, you know, and it's hard. And there's a lot of despair in those years, you know. Until you cross this Rubicon moment, I think, where if you just actually keep showing up through various, and self-effort does play a role in this. I'm not saying it doesn't.
Well, sure.
But what the effort is, isn't in, I'm going to fix myself, which would be a very one-ish thing to do, be a very eight-ish thing to do, right?
Yes,
I'm going to fix myself.
Right, right.
And then God's going to love me, right? When in reality, if you can finally just say, I can't fix myself, but what I can do is daily place myself in postures where God can get at me, then I can change. I will be changed. I can't change. I will be changed. And that's a great act of trust. And that is transformation versus reformation for me. Anthony, what do you think? Because you're imming along.
Yeah, no, I think that for me and my personal experience, what I've found is exactly the same kind of language I've used. It's about positioning yourself in a posture so that you are allowing yourself to be transformed. And I think, you know, we've talked about this on the show, that beholding gaze. And I think it's about being beheld. It's being in God's presence, being beheld. And I truly believe that's where our most dramatic transformation takes place, because the ultimate, just like Dr. Carroll was saying a few weeks ago, you know, we all long for intimacy, which is to be seen and to be known. And I think if we practice consistently positioning ourselves in a place where we're receiving that beholding gaze, then you begin to live from a place of being seen. You live from a place of being known instead of in search of it. And to me, that's the game changer for life.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is effort involved in the journey of transformation.
It's like you said, practice of putting yourself in a place so that you can be transformed. I mean, that's where the energy comes in, I think.
Yeah. It just can't be earned.
No.
It can be that's the difference. You know, if effort is a means of applying effort in your mind unconsciously is the formula for earning God's love and transformation, then you are way off base. You're way off base. So it's not about effort, isn't about earning. It's more about an effort toward actually opening ourselves up to the possibility of a transformed life. And then, like a little kid on Christmas morning, when the gifts start coming, you're just opening them up and you're going, oh my gosh, I didn't deserve this. Yeah. This is wonderful. Yeah. I didn't even try to make this happen. You know, like, holy smoke, I'm being transformed, right? Like, to me, that's why sometimes, Anthony, I get annoyed when I go to charismatic churches. I'm just going to be honest. Yeah. Okay, now I'm getting too honest for comfort here. But sometimes I'll get annoyed at certain, not all charismatic, but certain churches I've been to. And I'll go to them and I'll be like, man, you people are trying too damn hard. Like, there's a lot of striving in here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of jumping up and down and hands flying around. It's almost like, come Holy Spirit. And you're like, holy smokes. Like, really? Like, you're going to like boss God around?
And you get like, that, you get that feeling. This is like, I'm probably treading on ice here too, but that Old Testament reference of where the pagans, they think by their many words, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like, so by the fact that we're going to doing all this stuff, that God's going to come down from way up, you know, from way up over here.
Well, unfortunately, it's a little bit like the prophets of Baal.
Yeah.
Right? Like they end up cutting themselves to making God do something. Sometimes I get that feeling when I'm around certain Christian communities and I'm like, man, you're still in charge.
Yeah, right.
You look like you're letting go, but you are definitely still in charge.
Yeah.
Wow, we are really going on an edge today, aren't we? There's too much coffee.
So good.
Chris, what are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking a lot, actually. And I would love to know, maybe for our friends joining us. Sorry, I'm putting on interviewer mode here. I'm not the host of this show.
The Enneagram One is worried the wheels are coming off and is now taking the controls. No, go for it.
No, it's great. So I'm thinking about our friends joining us who are Enneagram Ones like me, or even threes. So we've been talking about like surrender and opening our hands and our hearts, but how do we not transpose this, guys, to passivity and then like que sera, sera? Because we're talking about surrender that requires intention and focus, not striving and effort. But how do we not conflate, for all of us, for me listening, joined in this conversation, how do we not conflate surrender with living a passive life and just, again, whatever happens, happens? Because that's not formative either.
No, but you're talking about the difference between passivity and receptivity.
Say more.
And well, receptivity could look like passivity.
Okay.
But it is actually very intentional. It is and this is a very scriptural idea, it is a waiting.
Mm.
It is a form of attentive waiting for God to do in us what we cannot do for ourselves. So you're on the edge of your seat. So you asked me about a practical. Okay, so some things that I do. Okay, so on a regular basis, I spend 20 minutes, 25 minutes in wordless prayer. And that wordless prayer is me just actually as receptively as I can sitting in what we might call Christian meditation. Mm-hmm. Where I am simply resting in the gaze of God. And as one great spiritual teacher said, don't get up until you hear God say, I love you. Just don't get up until you hear God say, I love you. And that to me is, it sounds passive. It doesn't sound like I'm read the latest books on productivity in the Christian life. There's no, it's actually just placing myself in the presence. Mm-hmm. And then giving God permission, consent, to rewire the heart, to remake my heart.
Yeah, because formation and transformation is not a life hack.
Mm-mm. No, no. And by the way, oftentimes practices like that one, I'll give you another one in a moment.
Yeah, sure, Ian.
So, all right, I'll give you a second one right now. Can you think of someone right now in your life for whom you are having an impossible time letting go of a resentment toward?
Immediately, yes.
Okay. So I'm going to, let's just do something crazy. Will you go with me on it?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, close your eyes for a moment.
Okay.
Okay. Now I'm going to give you an abbreviated version of this. So I want you to just close your eyes for a moment, and I want you to envision someone in your mind's eye for whom you have a great affection, that every time you see that person, you just feel a warmth and a goodness in your heart toward them. Do you have it?
I do.
Okay. And can you feel that in your body right now?
Oh, for sure. Immediately.
Yeah. Where is it?
In my chest.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so put your hand on your chest. Yeah. And just feel that. And in your mind's eye, just keep seeing that person's face. Yeah. Now, this is an abbreviated version. I want you to transition in your mind's eye to seeing this person that for whom you hold a resentment. And what feeling comes now?
A sharpness, but the feeling moved from my heart to my head.
Interesting. Okay, good. Okay. So now what I want you to do is say these words that I use in the show. Looking at that person in your mind's eye, you would just say, may you have love.
May you have love.
May you have joy.
May you have joy.
May you have peace.
May you have peace.
May you have healing.
May you have healing.
And may you have rest.
And may you have rest.
Now, what comes up for you as you see that person in your mind's eye for whom you have maybe even hatred? I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me. What comes up as you say those words?
It's like I can feel the transition trying to happen, but it's like it's shaken a little bit. It's not immediately transitioning into that place, but I can feel the cords of disdain, the cords of resentment, the cords of this should not have happened, you betrayed me, all of that. I can feel them loosening. So it's not fully descended into the somatic place of may you have peace, may you have joy, all of that. It's not there yet, but the pathway by which those cords of bitterness and disdain are loosening are by way of what you said. And it is me, the need is for me to keep going back to that place, to putting that person in my mind, in my heart, and repeating essentially that, Lord, I bless them. Lord, I show them grace and mercy as you've shown me. I speak life over their life, those type of things. A paraphrase of perhaps what you shared, but it's powerful, Ian.
So what happens is, and I can attest to this very powerfully. So in my own journey of transformation, like with my dad, my dad was a terrible alcoholic, mentally ill, drug addict, died from it. I had many, 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 many reasons, human reasons, why I could be resentful and hateful toward him. And I was for many years. And it ate me alive. Now, for him, you go to a pastor and you say, how do I get over that? And usually what they'll say is go to a therapist. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, why should I have to go to a therapist? Like, shouldn't you, I mean, you're like, shouldn't you know how to do this? Like forgiveness seems to be a Christian idea that we should know how to do. So in that practice, what happens is, first, usually what comes up is a lot of resistance. And as you do this work, right, you're going to feel resistance. Like, I'm not going to bless that bastard. That's the first thing you're going to feel. And you shouldn't judge it. Don't judge that. Like the Enneagram one would judge it like, oh my gosh, I'm a Christian. I shouldn't be feeling that way. It's like, no. Of course you should be feeling that way. It's called being human. You carry a wound and with it comes resistance to, you know, we go through decades of our lives choosing, we choosing wreckage over healing. I mean, really, we do. We just want to stay in it. So what happens is, I can just tell you, you do that practice 5 minutes a day on that person. May you have love. And I don't want you to say, oh, Lord Jesus, bless this person. Okay, because no, I actually want you to have to say it. Wow. I don't want you to have God. I want you to say, may you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. May you have rest. May you have every good thing I want for my life and the life of my children. May you have those things. And as you're seeing that person in your mind's eye, okay. And then when I'm working with people, sometimes I'll say, okay, do you have a mental picture of that person as an 8-year-old? And they'll be like, well, I've seen a photo of that person as a little child. Good. Use that now. And what I want you to do is what happens is over time, I think this is another way where we're just like saying, God, I can't do this, but what I can do is in your light and in your presence, wish these blessings for this person. And over time, what happens is you find that your heart miraculously is transformed. It's not because of what you did. It's not the technique. It's maybe it has to do with neural pathways. I don't know. All I do know is that when we place ourselves in these postures, that God gets at us. Mm-hmm. And you find that your heart is warmed and gentled toward the fact that that person is as spiritually sick as you were. And they behaved as a spiritually sick person would behave. And you find empathy and compassion in your heart. And one day, their name will come up, or you'll, after a couple of months of doing this, or whatever period of time you give to it on a regular basis, and suddenly you find that your nervous system isn't activated anymore. And you're like, how did that happen? And you'll just be like, well, I don't know. God and I sat in this person's presence, and it changed. And I changed. And it didn't have much to do with me. I just showed up and gave God permission to do it.
This is the power of forgiveness in a way, I think, is what I hear you saying. Yeah. Also, this is compassionate work. And then, so I'm thinking about the posture of my heart, maybe for the folks hanging out with us today too. A lot of us, I think, and this is the work of shame. And, you know, I talk about shame in the book as well, and how shame writes a new narrative. And the mode of shame is I have to either self-protect or self-promote. Why? Because the neurobiological desire is just to survive. And so, in a way, what I heard you saying there, Ian, is by way of that practice, we're back to surrender because we can't change it. The Lord has to. Our proverbial fists of self-protection and self-promotion drop, the heart opens, and now not only are we giving, but now we're open to receive for ourselves as well. That's what I heard you say in a way. Like a fresh portion of grace, a fresh portion that's always been ours as children of the King, but the isolation, the shame says, hide, you're not safe. Therefore, you have to take care of yourself. Why else now do you have to self-promote, self-protect? I mean, the circle just kind of continues, eh?
Yeah, exactly. So you have a thing, though, about renewing the mind. You talk about this four-step thing called SEED. I like a good acronym. As a person in recovery, we love us some acronyms.
Cool.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So SEED came out of really just some practices in my own life. It's an acronym, SEED, and I'll just kind of walk us through those, and then you can double click as you'd wish. But the first step in SEED is we're going to secure a thought so that we're consciously aware of it. We're going to hold it in our hands like a physical object. E is to examine the motivating factors of that specific thought with the leading of the Holy Spirit, scriptures, in my community of believers, with my counselor, my spiritual director, whatever. It's one thing to examine the root of a thought, and that's helpful, but now I have to expose true to truth. I have to expose that thought and perhaps the attached lie to truth. And I really believe that process of seed uproots its influence from our minds, from our neurobiology. And I do this with scripture. I do this with my therapist. I do this with my counselor, my pastor. And then the fourth step is to decide to consistently place our focus on truth. And that begins the process of installing a new thought in our minds. Because I really believe that the word, by the power of the Holy Spirit, contains the power to change our lives from the inside out. But this is repeatable. We need to do this on the regular basis. You know, the New Testament writer Paul said that this is the continual renewing of the mind.
Yeah, I mean, I love these. These are not hacks, by the way, people. These
Correct.
Are disciplines.
Yes.
And so, just to be clear, this is not a shortcut to, you know, spiritual maturity. These are just pathways. And there's lots of them, and there are many of which are helpful. And I keep going back up for some reason in my mind. It just keeps coming up. It's going to take a minute. I think our expectation is every time we read a book, whether it's an Enneagram book or it's a book on the heart, the transformation of the heart, we think, finally, and I'm going to read this book and I'm going to get it all down in a minute.
Yeah.
It's like, oh no, man, this is just another little bit of wonderful material to help you on a lifelong journey in the same direction.
It's good.
Man, what a rich conversation, Anthony.
Yes. It's what I expected from you, Christopher.
I love you both. You guys, I mean, this has been so rich and I'm just thankful. I learned so much. Honestly, I learned so much today and it sort of galvanizes even my desire to keep moving forward. I tell folks on the show this every week and I wanted to make sure it was clear in the book too, that transformation, like we've been saying here today, number one, it's not an overnight experience. It's not five steps to your best life. Transformation is a daily thing and it's...
It's the slowest of all human movements.
That it is, Ian. And it's not going to stop at any point in this finite physical life of ours either. We are moving on and journeying toward a place of maturity in Christ. And yeah, that's why I'm committed to the process.
So maybe this is to end on, maybe as an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is the point? That always seems to me like, what's the point, right? Like, I used to have to preach a lot. I'd write something. I think, what is the point?
Yeah.
Like, what was the point here? Like, you know, I think the point of the spiritual journey, the summa of the spiritual journey is union with God.
Yes. Theosis. Yes.
Right. And so that's why these practices, right? People, and it is a slow process. It is a counterintuitive process. It is a process that comes in at you slant. It will not come in through the front door of your intellect. It will come at you slant.
Wow.
For me, anyway, that has been the truth. And it is so easy, we make it hard.
Mm.
And one of the ways, for example, that we make it hard is by making up rules. Like, this is how it has to be done. And this is how, you know, it's like,
a life
hack. My gosh, rules, guidelines, and protocols, right?
Mm-hmm.
We make it so hard.
Eight easy steps, really, too?
Yeah. It's like, no, it's not, this isn't how it works.
Mm-hmm. Wow, Ian.
So a unitive knowledge of God seems to me to be the point of the spiritual journey. And to achieve it, sometimes we have these rare moments where we taste it, which, you know, is wonderful. Other days we feel very far from it, which might mean we were very close. We don't know, because our ability to actually assess the situation is usually very skewed.
Gosh, that's good.
You know, it seems to me that that's the whole point. And I think that's what I think I trust that you're talking about here. Like, you know, that healing happens when we achieve that state of union.
It is. That's right, Ian.
So, well, Christopher Cook, healing what you can't erase. What are you going to say?
I was going to say, speaking of healing that happens, where can people find your book and find you?
Yeah, everywhere. everywhere books are sold, Target, Amazon, Walmart, Barnes & Noble.
Costco.
I don't know if it's at Costco yet. I'm going to check, though.
Check!
I've got to check. Yeah, the book's available everywhere. Books are sold in hardcover, in audiobook format. I narrated it, which was fun.
Oh, that's great.
And then in Kindle as well. But yeah, everywhere you can get a book, the book is there.
And how do they find you?
Sure. So I host a weekly mental health, emotional health, spiritual formation podcast called Win Today with Christopher Cook. We do the deep dives much like we did today. That's a weekly podcast available everywhere. Podcasts are available, including YouTube. And then sort of home base for the book is healingwhatyoucan'terase.com. But the home base for all my work is wintoday.tv. Show notes for the show and stuff.
Great.
Sweet.
Hey, man. So good having you on.
Thank you, guys.
Chris, good. And Anthony.
Brother.
Buddy, after all these years, I still love you. Can you imagine?
Same.
Can you imagine? Is it even possible that I love you more now than I did then? The answer is yes.
Yes.
The answer is yes. And that goes for those of you who are listening. May you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. And may you have rest. Until next time.